With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. TNT Radio. This is Connecting the Dots with Matt Arrett on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back to Connecting the Dots for the third hour, where I'm very happy to be joined by somebody who has been on my radar for some time, but I didn't quite pay as much attention as I know that I should have. And it was only when I had watched a debate and I read a fantastic Substack post called David Icke's Gingerbread Cottage by James Dellingpole that I realized, wow, there is something of deep substance here. That was just fascinating, and I had to reach out to James to talk not just about this very fascinating post and his experiences with somebody who I think most viewers have heard of to varying degrees, David Icke, very influential amongst those who would rather not have a global totalitarian death cult running their world. It doesn't take you long before you stumble on David Icke, so we're going to talk a little bit about him, about James' insights there and his experience, but also about his thoughts more generally. James is somebody who is a former mainstream writer, newsmaker, writing for the Daily Mail and the Spectator and Daily Express. And I believe you were the former executive editor at Breitbart London. James, welcome on board. Thank you for devoting a little bit of your time to chat today.
Hey, Matt, and thanks for your reminder. Are you doing my show or not? Because I can be quite flaky at the weekends especially. So I'm really glad to be here on your show. I'm glad I didn't miss it.
Yeah, no, man, absolutely. No, and I'm glad that we're finally getting a chance to chat a little bit. So I guess first question, a little autobiographical for those who may not know your background a little bit. What was the thing that caused you? There aren't too many people that I know. There are a few, but not too many. Who have an established mainstream background and then found themselves just unwilling to go along with the comfort, the pay, all of the good stuff that you would get in the machine. And you're just, there's something that within you that was like, nah, I just can't do this anymore. So what was your story? What was your experience that caused you to shift gears and to craft your own little world?
Yeah, you're right, Matt. I was really establishment. I mean, as close to establishment as someone from my background can be, which is to say, you know, I wasn't born into the aristocracy, but I had a classic upper middle class education. I went to public school, private school, as you call it in Canada. I then went to Oxford, and I studied there and hung out with two guys who went on to become prime minister, David Cameron and Boris Johnson. After that, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I had a gift for writing. So I fell into journalism. And I spent about 5 years on the Daily Telegraph, on the staff, latterly as the arts correspondent. So working in the newsroom, but writing about the arts. I then became a columnist, and I was published. I mean, I wasn't at the very, very pinnacle, but I was pretty successful. I was a name journalist. People read my stuff. And I can say, a lot of people who have gone down the rabbit hole, as it were, say, how can the journalists not be aware that they are part of this lie machine? How can they be, you know, how can they be innocent? And I can tell you that despite my superb education and despite my reasonable intelligence, all the time I worked in the mainstream media, I genuinely believed that I was acting in good faith in an industry or a trade, as we call it, which was acting in good faith. I genuinely believe that I believe the legend. I believe the story, that the myth that journalists promulgate, which is we speak truth to power without fear or favor. And our job is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. You know, all these handy phrases that you've got, I think it's part of the brainwashing exercise that you kind of believe you're one of the good guys. And I thought that. And then I had this epiphany Or rather, I had a series of epiphanies. My first mini epiphany was when I started looking into climate change, the whole green industry, the climate industrial complex, you might call it. And I mean, I consider myself as somebody who is very much in tune with nature. You know, I've always loved the outdoors. My dad used to take us on these amazing holidays, and we used to collect reptiles and amphibians, and we used to, you know, so I was quite, we used to go out with linen bags and bring lizards back on the airplane to keep in our terrarium and stuff. So I was not some kind of ignorant towner who didn't care about nature. I was really immersed in this stuff. And yet I could see there was this clash between what the environmentalists were telling us about the planet and what I knew to be the case about the planet. So I started investigating this. And I began to realize that all the green stuff one read about in the newspapers, you know, about the planet is doomed because of man's selfishness and greed, and we must do something, we must act now, global warming is a serious threat. That was the first moment when I realized that the narrative we were being sold in the media did not accord with reality. And various people warned me off at this point. They said, James, you're a great writer, but this is not going to do you any good. This climate change, you know, you're starting to look a bit crazy. All the scientists say. So that was the moment when I first sort of started to question, to realize that the media did not necessarily give you the full picture. So then that was my first epiphany. My second epiphany was the Trump stolen election, as I would call it. I mean, I'm not a Trumpista now, but there was a time when I thought Trump was the savior. He was one of the good guys. And I could see the election, the presidential, being stolen from him in real time on TV. You know, you could see the ballot boxes being found by the roadsides. You could see video footage of ballot tampering and stuff. I could see a senile guy incontinent, probably in the pay of the Chinese government, somehow such a public liability that his minders wouldn't allow him on the campaign trail. I saw this guy, this vegetable to all intents and purposes, winning an election, stealing it from the most popular president in history, yada, yada. So that was my second wake-up call when I realized that here was a big story, an important story, you know, the leader of the free world having its presidency stolen by this crook. I mean, you know, well, stolen by a vegetable. And none of my media colleagues, the guys who I thought of as, you know, in the trenches next to me or in the foxhole next to me, none of these guys were reporting on stuff. They were saying, yeah, well, obviously Biden won because he was the better guy. You know? So that was when I parted company from, sorry, it's a long answer. That was when I parted company from the mainstream media, where I realized it wasn't what I thought it was. It was a lie machine.
No, and I appreciate you taking the time. Context is everything. So really great. And this touches a little bit on a newer post that you recently published on your Substack. Most journalists don't know they are cogs in an evil machine, and that's how the whole conspiracy works. And you bring up certain things, like you're very subjective. I really like that about your approach. You speak very autobiographically, which helps guide people a little bit. Like, it doesn't feel like it's a didactic, I am being told these things. Like, you're going through your own experience, your own transformations, your own discoveries. And one thing you said that really struck me is that there is this self-policing mechanism within the journalism field as this invisible force of self-policing. And you mentioned that nobody really touched 9/11, including yourself. I mean, you didn't know how to think critically about it at the time. And you even said that you even like had supported the bombing of Saddam Hussein at the time, as you know, and many people did who are not bad people. Like, we were all living in a field with these invisible fences in our mind. And it's not like everybody was in on it, on the big joke. Very few people actually understand how the game is played. And I appreciate how you're demystifying by this personal experience you're having and and your insights into the broader psychology. You're demystifying how this operates. Because could you say a little bit more about the self-policing?
Yeah, well, I think this is one of the important things that we need to realize, that The world is controlled and run by very, very, very few people. We're talking about maybe maximum, you know, the people who really run the world, 10,000 people. Now, what's the population? I mean, obviously they have minions, otherwise they couldn't do it. But what I'm saying is we are many, they are very, very few. They can't rule the world by force, that's a given. So they have to rule by deception. They have to encourage us through deception to be the jailers in our own prison. So it's all very well when governments set up forms of censorship. But the problem with that is that people react. People say, I don't want to be censored. I want to speak my mind. So by far the most effective form of censorship is self-censorship. And that very much applies in the world of journalism. Although most journalists, as I argued in that piece, really aren't aware of it. I wasn't. I thought of myself as a pretty smart cookie. You know, I'd had a ritzy education and stuff. And I looked around at my colleagues and they were all stand-up guys. You know, they weren't afraid to speak their minds. But the thing is, they weren't afraid to speak their minds on the issues on which it's safe to speak your minds. We imagined, I was a conservative commentator. So I imagined that I was quite edgy already because I was speaking in a world dominating by the evil left, you know. So it was just, you know, I was being pretty brave getting this stuff out and I was telling it like it is. And I was saying, you know, we really need to stop pussyfooting around with these rogue states like Iraq. You know, we need to be the world's, you know, America is the world's policeman and we need to you know, the Anglosphere, that's where it's at. And we need to run the world in interests of this thing called liberal democracy. See, what I didn't realize was that I was the subject of a lifetime's brainwashing where I'd already been put, little did I know it, into my conservative box. And I subscribed to all these notions, which I thought I had generated using my intelligence and my wide reading, whereas actually I was a prisoner of the Matrix, obviously, but I was fulfilling my designated role. I wasn't really free at all. I wasn't really expounding these interesting original ideas that I was playing my part. So, for example, you know, why did I support the first and second Gulf Wars? Well, the reason was that the people I knew and trusted supported the second Gulf Wars. You know, and when I wanted to refer to the kind of experts I could trust, I would refer to commentators like Douglas Murray. Say, you know, Douglas was a mate, and I thought Douglas worked for an organization called the Henry Jackson Society. And I thought, well, you know, they're on the right side because they're against Muslim extremism. And I looked around and I saw all these examples of Muslim extremism, you know, not least of which 9/11. You know, these Muslim extremists had waged war on the free world with their evil attack, planned by a man in a cave, a sinister man with his beard and his, you know, you know the story. It's like once you've bought into the narrative, you look around for confirmation bias and you get plenty of it. You're not going to look for the, you're not going to read The Guardian because they're the enemy. You're going to read the Telegraph because they've got ex-military men writing their columns every week. I mean, the Telegraph right now, the paper that I used to write for and I trust, has every week, it's got these Tweedledum and Tweedledee guys who I've no doubt are in the pay of the intelligence services because, you know, they just, it's war-to-war propaganda. And they're saying, we must give more arms to Ukraine. Every week, you know, there's another variant on the, we must arm Zelensky. Putin is evil. He's so evil. He's even more evil this week. Look at how great Zelensky is. One more push, one more weapons, you know, one more load of weapons. That's all we need. Or maybe next week they're doing Gaza instead. Gaza, we, you know, Hamas is so evil. We must kill more children. You know, that's how it works. You pick your team and you get sucked into it.
You could feel the presence of the ghost of H.G. Wells back when he was innovating the turning the Germans from likable, cultured people to baby killing Huns in World War One, working for Northcliffe and Beaverbrook, right? It's like it's the same thing. It everyone kind of just fell into lockstep of just, yeah, the Germans are baby killing Huns. It's like, yeah, but aren't we run by a German family in Britain? And you're like, no, yeah, but not those Germans, the other, not the Saxon-Coburg-Gotha Germans. No, it's the other ones that have the baby killing Huns. It's like,
yeah.
But yeah, let's stop in a.
I wasn't there. I remember Edith Cavell, the nurse who was murdered by these evil Germans. You know, I mean, that's how long the propaganda lasts.
Wild, eh? All right. Well, we're going to come back after a very short commercial break on today's News Talk TNT.
TNT's Steve Malzberg.
When I stepped aside, they said she stepped aside, but she's still here. When he stepped aside, end of an era. It's a guy thing, I know. But I have to just say, for women, we want our proper attention, too.
That is the most narcissistic thing I've seen since Barack Obama. This is about Mitch McConnell. And you're bringing up that he got too much credit or you got too little credit when you stepped down? That they called Mitch's reign and the end of it, the end of an era? And nobody said that about you? Nobody said that about you? You kidding me?
Steve Malzberg on today's News Talk TNT.
Hi. I'm your retirement fear, but don't be scared. You're still in pre-retirement.
Pre-retirement? Does that mean I have more time to plan?
Precisely. Here, this is pretirement.org.
Retirement savings options?
Oh.
Potential tax breaks?
Yep. Boo.
Oh, I could build up savings for my side hustle. This isn't scary. I'm doing it.
You got this.
Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan.
The Net Zero Con will leave millions of citizens dependent on state handouts.
It isn't a theory.
It's an agenda. There is no climate emergency. On air 24/7, this is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, we're back with Connecting the Dots, where I'm joined with James Dellingpole. And in hearing you speak a little bit about your, I don't like using the word awakening process, but whatever, the breaking out of Normieland process, whatever word you want to give it. I was thinking the global warming one for me was also a very big, big one. I had already kind of, my illusions about the political class was kind of shattered a bit earlier. I had stumbled on my own 9/11 discoveries that most people make, you know, it's not too hard to discover the official narrative is bunk. But I was still thinking at least science is pure, like the political system, it's corrupt, wars, murder of Kennedy by a shadow government. I was like, ah, that's painful. But I'm like, at least medicine, at least climate science, at least there's that we can hold on to. And yeah. And it was, I think, around 2007 or so that I came to realize, no, that's a giant. And it was naive of me to think that all of the power structures that would have been able to accomplish the sorts of things like 9/11, the imperial wars, the murders of presidents, that such a thing would not influence, obviously, the scientific domain. But that was like, when I finally got that, I felt like it was sort of like a master key where I was, a big vista of discoveries was open to me, because now all of a sudden I was like, oh, I could see that. Or I could think more critically about how people's minds are subtly conditioned by experts in a more concrete way than I could before that. So what you were saying about that also being sort of your gateway into thinking a lot more critically about reality is, it spoke to me.
But how did that science?
Yeah,
the science one is really exciting, actually, because okay. So when I was, I mean, I spent quite a long time fighting the climate wars, and there weren't many of us, not in the trenches. There really weren't. I mean, it was just, you know, a handful of skeptics, plus some elderly retired professors, mainly the people who went to the Heartland Institute conferences, and a handful of journalists. And I did that for a while, but at the time, you see, I was still not fully awake. I thought that it was just the field of climate science and ecology and environmentalism generally, that ragbag of kind of, you know, sort of fake science, social sciences, right? Basically, I thought it was just them that were corrupt. But when you realize that all of science, I mean, astronomy is bunk, Newtonian physics, when you realize that Principia Mathematica, which, you know, we're encouraged to think this guy with this wig, Isaac Newton, genius, you know, apple falls on his head. He discovers gravity. And he's a brilliant mathematician, a polymath, and he's one of the greatest Britons. There was a competition a few years ago on the BBC. I mean, which gives you a clue as to its integrity. And I'm pretty sure that Isaac Newton was there with Winston Churchill and Horatio Nelson and Isambard Kingdom Brunel, among the greatest Britons.
Aleister Crowley was on that list too. They gave Aleister Crowley a higher ranking than they did C.S. Lewis.
That was a different program. I can't believe that they didn't have Aleister Crowley as one of the greatest Britons. That's
one of the top 100 greatest Britons. Maybe.
Okay. But just dealing with Newton for a moment, nobody understood Principia Mathematica at the time, and no one has known it, understood it since. It's just everyone's taken everyone else's word for it that it's okay. Yeah, well, it must be. It's one of the greats, because that's how it was sold when it was released. There was a flurry of publicity and expectation about this publication. This goes back a long, long way. Paleontology, completely fake. I don't know about geology. I expect there are areas which are uncorrupt.
No, Charles Lyell was a fraudster. He was trying to cover up he was trying to impose gradualism and destroy any evidence of discontinuous leaps in the geological records. So yeah, absolutely.
So there you are. I mean, yeah. Lyell, I imagine, is one of the kind of the cornerstones of geology. So if that cornerstone is pulled away, then that the edifice collapses. So then you've got anything to do with evolutionary theory, which I imagine means most fields of biology. So that is bunk. And at the same time, you've got institutions like the BBC. I mean, one can't mention the evil of the BBC often enough. The BBC venerates scientists. Now, that ought to be a tell in itself. Any group of people that the BBC venerates are almost certainly charlatans. But it's particularly interesting for me, Matt, that as somebody who, as an English literature graduate, has spent most of his life being told by scientists, well, of course, you literature students don't know anything, you know, and you know, you should study a hard subject. I'm not disputing that physicians are clever people. I mean, as in people who study physics, I don't mean doctors. but it's really good to realize that actually, whereas I spent my whole life feeling rubbish that for having studied this frivolous subject like reading novels and poems and stuff, actually I'm probably better grounded in reality than the people who've been studying these made up nonsense subjects at university.
No, I think it's a good point. And I think, let me ask you this as a follow-up there. What do you think of, since you brought this up, the prevalence of occultism in the backdrop of a lot of the accepted standard model theories, yes, of whatever domain, right? Whether it's Darwinism or whether it's Newtonianism, you always seem to have the hand of Rosicrucians, Hermetic, yes, Orders of the Golden Dawn, Theosophists, always kind of there, interfacing with like Alfred Russel Wallace, right? A co-founder of Darwinism, was also a top dog at the, yeah, British Society for Psychical Research. And you've got Thomas Huxley was a major spiritualist trying to communicate with the dead. And then Darwin had his own hand. Newton had his own handlers as well amongst the Rosicrucian crowd of like Cokes and others who were all doing weird alchemy, hermetic witchcraft, numerology, and Newton himself, when they found his trunk of papers that John Maynard Keynes finally purchased that was in the basement of Cambridge, and he made a big press conference And the idea was finally we were going to see how did he make his discoveries. Nobody ever read it. And he opens up this trunk and it's like just 20,000 pages of witchcraft. So what's your take on that element?
Well, look at the world's most distinguished scientific institution, the Royal Society, founded 1660. Newton was a leading player. I don't think he was a founder member, but you know, Boyle, Hooke, all these great names. I think pretty much to a man, they were high level Freemasons, weren't they? I mean, that's the thing. They were all into the occult, and you haven't even mentioned the Big Daddy, Francis Bacon. I mean, he's the guy who inspired them all. He was an occultist. He was, you know, had his scrying glasses. He used his scrying glasses to call up the storms, supposedly. He used his powers to call up the storms that sank the Spanish Armada. These people engaged in witchcraft, in magic spells and stuff.
That's how spoke the Enochian language to communicate with the spirit beings of the beyond,
the demons.
Do the bidding of the empire.
When you know that, and as for evolutionary theory, when you you can read the minutes of high level Freemasons where they talk about how they're going to introduce this idea into the system that you know man was not created by God, that man evolved from you look into who funded the hypochondriac Darwin, who was himself I think a very high level Freemason. You suddenly realize that these people that you were taught at school were the pillars of modern knowledge, and actually they're all corrupt. They're all batting for the wrong team, basically, Matt. they're all wrong'uns, and it leaves you slightly rudderless because you start asking questions like, who can you trust? And then you go through the black pill phase, don't you? Where you become slightly cynical.
That's a natural. It's a natural thing to wrestle with when you're encountering this. But have you looked at? Because for me, one thing that I had encountered, fortunately, in my searching was some of the writings of he's now dead, Lyndon LaRouche. Have you looked at he's an American philosopher, and he said some stuff that I found interesting, and he made the point that most of the discoveries, so-called, in science were plagiarized and removed of their soul and turned into simple dead formulas to be memorized with a bunch of false assumptions inserted. But the real current of science he was alluding to did exist, but you have to look at who is having their work and discoveries stolen by people who are controlling, like a Newton, or there's a lot. There's a big list of a lot of these Royal Society thinkers, like a Kepler or a Leibniz. Have you looked into the positive currents of like the people who are making potent discoveries and finding their discoveries?
I haven't gone that down the particular rabbit hole, but what you said just then reminds me that there is an analog in the. So you talk about how we sort of know these scientists and their discoveries by these formulae and these phrases that, you know, I mean, like Einstein equals MC squared. And it's taken as read that somebody else has checked out this stuff, done the math. They know it checks out, or all the calculations that show that the sun is what is it? 66,000 miles away or something. They're all these kind of, Or is it the speed that the sun revolves at, or the earth revolves around the sun?
I don't remember the metrics.
The point is that they had to get the number 66 into it. But there's an analogy in the world of our knowledge about everything, which is that quotations. This is another of my Substack essays that I wrote that I noticed that we've a lot of the most fraudulent people in history happen to have handy quotations. Einstein, for example, was a quotation machine. There are so many handy quotes attributed to Einstein. Now you ask yourself, this guy, his first language was German. I think he spoke with a a strong German accent, didn't he, when he came to, even when he came to the US. And yet this guy was spouting out lines like H.L. Mencken. He was, or Mark Twain, another character that we're told is one of the wittiest man in civilization. And I think that one of the ways that our controllers imprint ideas in our head is they recognize that we haven't got time to do all the heavy reading. So they just give us these handy quotes to show us what to think. So, you know, whatever it was that a leap, one small step for man, a great leap for mankind, you know, this imprints in everyone's head that this handy quote that definitely Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, you know, walked on the moon, because how could he have invented that quote if he hadn't done it? There's another one. There's a film that I'm determined not to see, which is Oppenheimer.
Because I saw that. Yeah, it's terrible propaganda. It's so bad.
I don't want to.
No, your decision is correct. I endorse your decision.
But what do we know about Oppenheimer? One of the things we know is that when he kind of creates the atom bomb, he says, what is it? I am become something, a destroyer of worlds. He quotes the Bhagavad Gita.
Years later, he's describing the type of power he felt with this power at his disposal. Yeah. And he cites the Bhagavad Gita and describes the story of this god Vishnu trying to convince the prince to do his duty or something, which involves somehow burning the world in purgative violence.
Yeah.
And says, I am now just.
I have become God, destroyer of I've become God, destroyer of the world. Okay. So this is designed for smart asses like you and me, Matt. You know, we go, he's quoting the Bhagavad Gita. And did you know that he was a Sanskrit scholar? And I know this quote. I've heard this quote. And it's like, destroyer of world. And what it does is it reifies this thing. It sort of imprints something in your imagination that, like, this is the sort of thing that the guy who discovered how to invent who invented the atom bomb would have thought at that moment. And he was aware of the momentousness of it and that how the world would be changed. And what this does is it makes clever people think they understand something they don't understand, because nukes are fake like everything else. Do you see how it works? It's part of the programming.
In the specific thing of the nukes being fake, I'm not on board with that necessarily, but in the general statement you're making, I completely am on board with the general point you're making. And it's one of these things which it's like for good or for evil, right? Like rhetorical tools, poetry in speech is something which, if you're a good person, great. You know, you will use poetry, these types of, like, if you're a Thomas More and you love humanity and you care about people, you will be able to utilize, or Erasmus, you know, you'll use the art of rhetoric in a way that makes people better in some way or more insightful with a simplification in a poetic adage. But at the same time, that's a power to do bad too. If you have hate in your heart, or if you're animated by something else, you could use that power to put people into hypnotic inductions. And
It's funny, you talk about hate in your heart. The thing that prompted my essay on quotations and the misuse thereof was that when I used to be really into war. I had loads and loads of war books, you know, about Hitler's war machine, and I knew all the different types of tanks and the different kinds of aircraft and stuff. And when my kids were growing up, I used to take them to the Imperial War Museum in South London, where I lived at the time, and, you know, looked at all this war stuff. And as you go down into the trench area where they recreate the sounds and smells of the trenches, you know, you can smell the kind of the saltpeter from the bullets and stuff, and the smell of the smell of gas and something. And you go down this ramp, and on the side of the wall are all these quotations from classical authors talking about the inevitability of war and how much men are geared towards war and why war is important. And there was one of those superhero movies where the characters, I think it was one of the female superhero films, where sort of set where it was full of classical quotations. And some of these classical quotations I discovered had basically, but you couldn't trace them to their origins. They were attributed to classical authors, but they were not verifiable. And I realized that what Hollywood, being the lie machine, does is it uses classical references to persuade the susceptible that actually war is a natural state of man, that we are geared towards war, and that this is what we want to do, and we can't help it because that's human nature. I don't think it's true. It's what they, the people who program us, want us to think. But I don't think most people actually do want to spend their time, you know, banishing another guy so that his guts spill out on the ground and he dies whimpering for his mother.
Look,
not
if
really.
People are happy and satisfied and content, they're going to get bored. And when they're bored, they're going to have to kill their neighbors. James, come on. Naturally.
Yeah.
It's so cynical. Well, look, let's pick this up after a short commercial break. We'll be right back on today's News Talk TNT.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Tonight, Joe Biden will give what will hopefully be his final State of the Union. This, as a new Bloomberg poll shows, that 80% of Americans think he's too old to do the job. And this is what they think of him on Italian television.
Buonasera, Presidente Biden. Oh, Presidente Biden. President, Mr. President. It's okay.
President.
Okay. Tutto posto. Well, benvenuto. No, di nuovo. Mamma mia.
Kind of creepy, right?
No.
What's your name?
Con chi parla? Mr. President.
My name is Joe Kennedy.
No, Biden. Lei è Biden. Biden. Ma con chi parla?
Certo, prego. Ecco, se riesce, if you can. No. Sta girando su. No. No, Mr. President, not turn, you have.
Hello,
to...
my name is Joe Kennedy.
You know, even if Biden were to behave that way during the State of the Union, our media would give him rave reviews. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg. Catch my show Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. Eastern, but starting next week, 10 p.m. Eastern, right here on TNT.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands, heal our waters, and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. But every day we lose more of the places we love, and we urgently need to save endangered lands, waters, and wild species. The actions we take today will determine the tomorrow we leave to our children and grandchildren. The water they drink, the air they breathe, the beauty they experience. To learn more about how you can help protect and conserve our beautiful world, visit nature.org today.
This is Connecting the Dots with Matt Arendt on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back for the third segment. It's where I'm speaking with James Dellingpole. And I'd like to just wind out today's show on something that you did that, again, put you on my radar in a way. You were sort of on the back burner, but I really, really, really respected what you did and how you did it in terms of expressing your insights regarding a certain very influential figure who people should really think pretty critically about, amongst the so-called, I don't know what to call it, the health freedom, the truth movement, I don't know, David Icke, who I had read back in when I was trying to make sense of things early on in my learning curve in 2004. That was when I was shaken up, and one of my friends had given me a copy of it wasn't even a friend. It was I got it from one of the biggest bookstores in Canada, Chapters Indigo. They had a David Icke section. So that should have already had me questioning, since the head of Chapters Indigo hosted a Bilderberger meeting that same year. I should have been thinking more critically. But anyway, I bought the book and it was Tales from the Time Loop. And I was persuaded by a lot of the elements and the mechanics of like why our lives are a giant lie. But then there were things that made me uncomfortable regarding, you know, shape-shifting lizards at the end of the day. That's one of the punchlines, sucking our fear energy. And that if we want to fight this thing, we just need to put out good vibes of love. And it got, I was like, I can't go with you on this journey. This is a little bit too much. But you were brought into a discussion. What I guess was you were thinking was going to be a
friendly discussion. It. I mean,
oh, you initiated it. You actually reached out and asked to have a chat.
Well, in the sense that, okay, so I do live events every now and again, and I try and think of somebody. Obviously, you want somebody who's going to draw a crowd and who's going to give you an interesting conversation. I mean, I don't do interviews. I think the interview format is stupid. It's something that I used to engage in when I was in the mainstream. But conversations are much more enlightening, and I don't require people to have prepared, because I think two intelligent people can sit down and easily for an hour, you know, probably 5 hours without having to do their homework. So that's what I expect of my interlocutors in these situations. I just want somebody who's not stupid, who's got some interesting ideas, and we can have a good old chat. I, against my better judgment, I decided to do one with David Icke. I say against my better judgment. I suppose the reasons I wanted to do a show with him were, one, he's kind of the granddaddy of conspiracy theorists. You know, I hate using that term, but you know, Bill Cooper is no longer with us because conspiracy theorists tend not to live forever. Lots of people who are, let's say, awake down the rabbit hole. David Icke was the guy who turned them onto these ideas about the world not being as it seems. I have to say, I'd never read one of his books, and I'd never been exposed to any of his ideas personally, but I knew lots of people who had been, who kind of look up to him, go to his events. So once he'd said yes, I didn't spend too much time looking into his background. You know, I was aware of a few of the things he'd said and done on Twitter, and I thought, well, this, you know, he sounds like he's on the right track. But what I didn't do deliberately was look into those people who say this guy is a charlatan, he's not what he claims to be, yada yada. I thought, I don't want to confront him on stage. That's not my style. I don't want it to be a gotcha event. I want it to be a meeting of minds, you know, seeing what we have in common and talking about those, you know, putting aside any differences we might have. Anyway, I'm on stage with David Icke, and I had been warned about this, but until I experienced it myself, I hadn't realized how bad the situation is. The guy is incapable of having a conversation. You will ask him a question, and it's a bit like pressing an old jukebox. You know, you press the button, and the needle goes, and then you are committed to. I mean, you know, a pop single lasts maybe 2.5 minutes. Unfortunately, you get more like half an hour of monologue. Now, this for me ought to have been a tell. Indication that this guy is not very quick on his feet. He's like, he can only operate according to a particular program. You can't surprise him with it. He doesn't bat and forth ideas, which is what I wanted. I wanted to talk about ideas. You know, I mean, I'm interested in his theories about what happens when you die. He's got this something about you're not meant to follow the light or something, because if you follow the light, that's a trick, and you enter this thing called a soul trap. I want to know about this crazy stuff. So I had a fairly grim old time of this guy doing these monologues, not talking to me, just kind of turning away.
I noticed
from
that
he never
looked at you once. There's no eye contact.
I tell you what, Matt, it's a painful experience. If you feel free to look up, it's available free now to watch this so-called debate, discussion, whatever. It was none of those things. It was kind of me going increasingly frustrated as this rather dreary man rehearses these rather stale ideas, which you can't pick him up. You know, at intervals, you want to say, well, hang on, can you explain this point? Defend it. Show me where you get these ideas. But you can't do it because he won't be interrupted. You've got to wait for him to finish his point, which may take 10 more minutes, 20 more minutes. And you're just going, why did I say yes? Anyway, people thought that I was ungracious. People thought that I should be, you know, I should show more respect to the guru, because after all, this guy had been doing it since 1990, when I was still a kind of complete normie, still believing 9/11 was planned. But well, I know that was after 1990. But you know what I mean? I believe that Kennedy was assassinated by Lee Harvey Oswald. But anyway, so after this event, which was kind of a polarizing experience, because I started facing the wrath, not just of the Ike family. Ike in particular started sort of, you know, picking up on anything critical I said about this event. You know, my private channel was sort of picked up on and amplified before Ike's 500,000 followers on Twitter. You know, it was almost like he was determined to court martyr status, which was another tell for me. I mean, I get given grief by people, by people who hate me, but I don't go on Twitter and say what a martyr I am and how everyone's ignored me. I just sort of get on with it and just ignore the haters. Yeah. I mean, that seems to be... Ike really plays up to this idea that, yes, I've been right all along and so many people have mocked me and now see how right I am and what a martyrly martyr I am. So that's the second tell. So tell number one, he cannot do conversation. So that raises suspicions, because in my experience, people who are telling the truth, who've got nothing to hide, are really, really, they can talk about any subject. That you can't catch them out, because they said, like, what true thing can I tell you that I think about this? Whereas people who are deceptive, they're willing to
say that they don't know something, right? Like, honest people don't know everything, and they're open about telling you the best reasons why they have a hypothesis. And what they, yes, they're willing to say that they don't know. I'm like, oh, good point. And that's how the conversation works. Versus
exactly. So we've got tell number one, tell number two, sort of martyr. Tell number three, very prickly, very kind of defensive, very kind of evasive. Anyway, I start doing the research that I didn't do before the event, for the reasons I've explained. And I looked into the background of Ike, and there's lots that's very suspect about him. Number one, he claims to have got his information from a form of kind of supernatural intervention. The voices in his head in South America, under the influence of ayahuasca or whatever, these voices told him stuff. And when you look at his early work, it's very... it's very redolent of, although he denies plagiarism, it's very redolent of the teachings of Madame Blavatsky, the founder of Theosophy in the late 19th century, which was the birthplace of, I mean, through Aleister Crowley and people like that, very fashionable H.G. Wells in the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah.
It later became it morphed into the New Age movement. And yeah. What I realize is that Ike, pretty much without crediting his early sources, is regurgitating Theosophy, which was essentially repackaged Babylonian mystery religions. Oh, the other tell, of course, was that he's very anti-Christianity, it's known that I'm a Christian, and he attacked me on stage. He called it your freaking religion. And I thought that was suspect as well. It was like kind of the raging of demons against the demons don't like Christianity. And I realized that he's, I called my article, which you read, David Icke's Gingerbread Cottage. Because what Ike is like a lot of these gatekeepers. You remember that famous Albert Pike quote, if they need heroes, we shall supply them. And there are all these figures who are presented to us in the awake movement, the questioning movement, as these gurus. And they are false
prophets. That was in the same book where he said Lucifer is God. But yeah.
There you are. You see that whichever force of light that Ike is invoking and encouraging his audiences to move towards, it ain't the light of Christ. It's the light of, it's false light of Lucifer. Yeah, I called it the gingerbread cottage because, and this is a common problem with people in the truther movement, the awake movement, whatever you want to call it. They've come to the point where they've realized that everything that they've been told is a lie. So they're looking for some kind of somebody who can explain things as they really are. And they come to this guy, David Icke, who seems to be right about so many things. You know, he was right about all these false flag operations, and he was right about the people who run the world, and so he must be right about everything. And that's the moment of danger. He lures you to his gingerbread cottage with all these, it's a lovely cottage made of these sweet, delicious things, and you gorge yourself on, and you know what happens in the gingerbread cottage? The witch then comes out and catches you and puts you in her oven. That is, he's the new age trap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and you said it explicitly. I pulled out this quote where you said David Icke shares the same religious belief system as the wicked master rulers he has spent the last 30 years supposedly exposing. And it's true. Like, and you cite, it would have been nice if you had seen these videos and you did this work before the confrontation on the stage, yeah. But that's okay. Hindsight's 2020. You did a great job with your write-up afterwards. And I watched both videos you cited. And sure enough, yeah, if you go back to his early writings after his big weird awakening in Peru, where he came back with this idea that he's somehow like a messiah figure, if not like a messiah avatar, I don't really know. It's very clear when you contrast that exactly to Annie Besant and Bailey and Blavatsky's theology and cosmology. It's Gnostic, of the worst kind of Gnostic mysticism of a pagan variety of light bearers and frequencies. And it's like, where does reason and morality come into your discussion? It's all about frequencies,
here's the thing.
Of light.
Yeah. Here's the thing, Matt. You know, like, it may be, it's possible that the Gnostics are right. You know, that the Freemasons are right, and that we are all fools, you know, we ignorant Christians and stuff, or we useless eaters who haven't got this occult knowledge, you know, that they understand the true nature of the world. You know, that's an argument I'm prepared to hear from Ike on stage, you know. If that's the case he wants to make, then I'm really interested to hear it. I mean, really interested. I want to see where he's coming from. But if he's going to come up with all this stuff about the dark rulers of the world and you know how sinister they are, and then, as you've just repeated, if he's going to embrace the very philosophy that they embrace, I think he's got some explaining to do, and he hasn't done that explaining at all. He needs to come clean.
Yeah. No, I feel like that's always the frustration when you're dealing with sophistry, is that it wants to be innocuous or have this force field from reason. It's like you have to have this like esoteric experience or set of experiences through interfacing with the hidden masters of some, you know, transcended domain that bestow some messaging from the Black Lodge or the White Lodge into you. Like, and if you don't go through that experience, then you don't have true knowledge. That's only for the yeah. inner elite. And so it's beyond reason. You can't discuss it. You can't question it. You have to just accept it. And right there, that's a toxic, poisonous, you know, concoction.
Yeah.
If we allow that into our world too much. At all.
Yeah. It stopped me being an elitist. I mean, I'm with the people on this. I don't like these cabals. I don't like I don't like things that are secret, because de facto they are not good for the broad mass of people, and I'm with the people.
Yeah, like I get it, you know, sometimes, you know, you're in battle against evil, you gotta maintain intelligence, communications, and keep secrets. I get it. But at the same time, you don't want to build a whole institution on secrecy as an institution, as a way of being, or as a Tao or whatever, like that. No.
Yes. Just,
and it's like a necessary tool you might have to use in battle at some point, not putting all you can't win a hand of poker if you just overshow everybody your cards.
There is that.
Yeah.
It has its place. It has its place. Yeah, yeah, it does. Like what I got up to in Amsterdam that weekend, you know, whatever.
What? I don't know what you're talking about. So, no, James, like, honestly, I really appreciate your Substack. Your work is fantastic. It, I think, gives people a greater space, more vistas in the mind to move in. And your immersion with literature, I think, has also given you an edge, an insight that is lacking in this overly literalist, materialistic world that we're living in, where people just can't navigate through a metaphorical language or just think a little bit laterally sometimes, which is really important because the oligarchy kind of does in a weird way. So that being said, we got 30 seconds left. Where do people go to follow your work, subscribe, support you?
Well, I've got a podcast called The Delling Pod. And I'm very proud of it. And I talk to interesting people. I'm hoping you're going to come on one day, Matt. I also do a separate one on the Psalms. I'm really interested in the Book of Psalms, which is the key to so much wisdom, and it will lead you to the true light of God.
Thank you, James. Thank you, everyone. Take care.